Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is off this week. After a regular season, the league, players, and fans might want to forget. The NBA playoffs begin today. Here to bring us beyond discussions of tanking, brawls, and suspensions, and into the magical world of the playoffs is Boston Globe columnist and longtime NBA observer Bob Ryan. Bob, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Karen.
Let's start with Western Conference matchups. Golden State, which had missed the playoffs each season since 1994, will take on the league's best regular season team, the Dallas Mavericks, which had won 67 and lost only 15 games. But some suggest that the matchup may not be so lopsided. Why?
Because the Warriors actually won the season series 3-0, which has mystified one and all. I think most people put no stock in that whatsoever. It's just one of those quirky things. I don't think anyone seriously thinks the Warriors have any hope of winning more than one game in that series when they start playing for real.
You are very much disappointing my colleague.
Sorry. I'm happy that the Warriors have made it. I'm an old friend and admirer of Don Nelson, who has perked up the franchise and given them new life, and they made a wonderful trade in the middle of the year that helped them, and this is their reward. This is like being nominated for the Oscar when you know that Nicholson's going to walk off with the prize. your reward, your Oscar is your nomination. Their Oscar is getting in.
The Phoenix Suns won 61 games this season, 19 more than their first-round opponent, the Los Angeles Lakers. This would also be a mismatch, but Kobe Bryant's always capable of scoring 50 points a game, right?
That is correct, and he will probably come up with one, and they will win that game, and that will be the only one they will win. Phoenix is ready to go. I believe they're reasonably healthy. They should have minimal trouble beating the Lakers, but it will be an entertaining thing because Kobe is the league's MEP, most entertaining player.
Houston and Utah would appear to be an intriguing matchup, not just because of their nearly identical records, but also because their styles of play more closely resemble that of most Eastern Conference teams. Maybe Commissioner Stern should move those teams to the East next year.
They are rather quintessential Eastern kind of teams, although I must say that Utah, which has traditionally been a very stick-in-the-mud conservative walk-up team, has the most devastating offense that they've had probably in the whole time that Jerry Sloan has been coaching the team, which has been since 1989. This is an intriguing matchup. There are those who like this as much as any in basketball and would like to see it because there's a case to be made for each of these teams upsetting people on right to the finals. This is a knockdown dragout. I can see this going no fewer than the limit. I'm going to pick Utah, but I think this is going to be a terrific series.
Well, speaking of the East, Miami and Chicago, which many pundits thought would be the number one and number two seeds at the start of the season, are instead seeded number four and number five and face each other in the first round. Can we just consider this series to be the conference finals?
Chicago finds himself in this predicament because they lost the last game of the season. Mm-hmm. Had they won it, they would have been second and would be playing Washington. This is a very, very regrettable thing they have done, losing that final game. Miami is healthy and ready to go. Healthier. I don't know if Dwayne Wade will, how long it will take him to get back to his pre-injury condition, but the interesting thing that's happened this year, two things have happened with this team on the court. Shaq is playing better earlier than usual. He played very well in the last month, and usually he saves himself of late until the spring. And secondly, Jason Capono, the itinerant jump shooter from UCLA, has found a home and has had a tremendous year, gives them a new threat from the outside. I think they will prevail in that series.
The Washington Wizards, which at one time sat atop the East, lost its two best players to injuries and must now face the Cleveland LeBrons without Gilbert Arenas and Caron Butler. Should Washington just forfeit this series?
Well, the fans should mentally forfeit it and then accept any little goodie they get, like maybe like a halftime lead. This has all the makings of a sweep. And it's too bad that Washington was one of the more intriguing teams, certainly in the East, before the injury struck. I would say that it would almost go to the point of saying that it's too bad that they couldn't just cede their spot in the playoffs to someone else. For example, Philadelphia, who really played well after they traded Allen Iverson and probably would give Cleveland a better fight right now than Washington will.
Bob, I'm looking at the other two first-round matchups, Detroit, Orlando, and San Antonio, Denver, and I'm having a hard time finding anything interesting about them.
Oh, I must say that you didn't look hard enough in the West. Denver has come on. It took a while. Once, you know, when Allen Iverson arrived there, Carmelo Anthony was serving his suspension in the aftermath of the big brawl in New York in December, and it took a great deal of time before they began to mesh, but they have. They came on very strong. There are people who think that they're a sleeper team in the West to cause some damage. I don't think they're going to beat San Antonio, but I think they're going to make San Antonio work for it. But I would keep my eye on that series. Right. The other series is of surpassing no interest whatsoever to anybody outside the two cities involved. Detroit will roll over Orlando. If Orlando wins a game, I'd say stop the presses.
Veteran NBA referee Joey Crawford, who allegedly challenged San Antonio forward Tim Duncan to a fight during a game last Sunday, was suspended for the remainder of the season. It's quite unusual for the league to punish officials. What other factors are going on here?
Well, according to the commissioner, Joey is not a first-time offender. Principal Stern has called young master Crawford into the office on more than one occasion, we learn. And obviously, whatever instructions he gave him as to how to handle himself, young Mr. Crawford did not heed. One thing that all the great referees in my experience have shared is a outsized personality and an autocratic nature, and Joey is in that mold. He's come to a point where he feels the games are his games to run in his manner. He's been in the league 31 years. He's clashing with a commissioner who has evolved to the point where he takes everything in this league personally, in my opinion. Everything is about David framing it and how I want to see things, how I want to see things done. But I think the key phrase that the commissioner used was lack of control. Joey exhibited a lack of control in that instance.
Bob, you're an entertaining guy, so please entertain our listeners with entertaining playoff picks for entertainment purposes only.
Entertainment playoff picks. I believe that San Antonio is a very good pick to win this whole thing. Though Dallas had the 67 games, I want to see how they do in the playoffs against a motivated San Antonio team. San Antonio-Phoenix is going to be a tremendous series eventually. I root for Phoenix, but the pragmatist in me says that San Antonio's defense and their combination of defense and explosiveness with people such as Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker augmenting the ever-stoic, ever-reliable Tim Duncan and the great coaching of Greg Popovich. I see them defeating Detroit in a, frankly, not a memorable final.
Bob Ryan is a columnist for the Boston Globe and joins us from time to time to talk pro hoops. Thanks again, Bob.
Welcome, Karen.
If you noticed Atlanta Braves fans seemed restless, unsettled, and bored last October, there was good reason for that. After winning 14 straight division titles, the Braves missed the 2006 playoffs. But as Ron Schachter reports, the team's off-season moves have fans confident that henceforth, Atlanta will not be idle come autumn.
The Atlanta Braves may have received more attention for missing the playoffs last year than for making 14 straight trips to the postseason. But if you think their star is in decline, third baseman Chipper Jones begs to differ.
We got too many good players. We've addressed the one glaring need that we had. We won 79 games last year and we blew 29 saves. So if we convert half of those, we win as many games as any division title winner last year.
The Braves have traded recently for closer Bob Wickman and top-notch setup men Rafael Soriano and Mike Gonzalez. Bobby Cox, now in his 22nd season as Atlanta's manager, says those deals should make a big difference.
The name of the game has always been pitching, and we were a little short last year. So getting Soriano, Gonzalez, and getting Wick signed up made us darn strong out there. And I think we'll still score as many runs. So, you know, the team itself was good last year. We had one soft spot, and we fixed it, and we think we'll contend again.
And so far, the Braves are back to their winning ways. They sped to a 7-1 record to start the season, and since then have jockeyed with the New York Mets, last year's division champs, for first place in the NL East. But if this year's fix seems quick and easy, Atlanta's long-term success is another story. General Manager John Schuerholz is in his 17th season with the Braves.
It's been one of my operating principles since I've been a general manager now 26 years. Keep the pipeline of talent filled. And that demands that you have an outstanding scouting program and as well a development program that complements that scouting program. Find the raw material and put it in the hands of talented craftsmen and artisans to polish it off and finish it. Put it in the pipeline. Have it matriculate to the major leagues, available to you for you to use to help make your major league club better by their own abilities or have them available to trade to another organization that has the exact piece you need to get back.
That pipeline has produced three generations of homegrown Braves, from prize pitchers John Smoltz and Tom Glavine to superstars Chipper and Andrew Jones to young all-star catcher Brian McCann and right fielder Jeff Francoeur, who hit 29 homers and knocked in 103 runs last year. 2 years ago, the Braves won the NL East title with 18 rookies. Chipper Jones, who has a lifetime batting average above 300 and more than 360 career home runs, says that the new generation arrived ready to contribute and familiar with the Braves' way.
Well, I think the Braves are really good at making sure that young kids are truly ready to play in the big leagues before they get here. There's a certain type of player that you have to be to play here. Not only do we bring in good players, we bring in good people, we bring in good teammates, people who have their own agenda, usually don't stay here very long. And there's a tremendous amount of pride and camaraderie that goes along with donning this uniform.
While other elite teams like the Yankees, Red Sox, and Mets have splurged on free agents, the Braves have cut their payroll over the past 2 years from $100 million to $80 million. Their abundance of lower-priced young players has also allowed them to trade for key veterans, including starting pitcher Tim Hudson and shortstop Edgar Renteria. Starter John Smoltz has been here since 1988 and has won 195 games and saved another 154 during a four-year stint as the team's closer. He admires the Braves' versatility.
The one thing that we've done here is with different types of teams we've won. It hasn't been like a group that stayed together forever. We won with speed, we won with defense, we won with pitching, we won with power.
For all the Braves' keys to success, though, the team has labored under a reputation as an also-ran in the postseason. That view rankles veterans like Smoltz.
Say what you will, people can try to take apart what we haven't done versus what we have done and look at it as somewhat of a failure, and we don't look at it that way. We look at it as 14 straight years we had a chance to do something special. Unfortunately, we only had one World Series out of it, but I like the chances of knowing every year that you got a chance to win it versus maybe winning it 1 year and disappearing for 5 years.
For now, the Braves are focused on winning their 15th division title in 16 years and getting back to the World Series. But, adds Chipper Jones, they also won't forget their unparalleled run of athletic success.
I don't think it'll really truly be appreciated until this generation is done playing, to be honest with you. I think it'll be 15, 20 years down the road before people look back and say, wow, that really was a tremendous, tremendous feat.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Chapman.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is hyperventilating and unable to speak after hearing the news of the WUSA's reappearance. Ahead on Only a Game, ATVs rumble to the rescue of a New Hampshire mill city. But first, Hanover, New Hampshire fans are currently enjoying a sports dynasty. Dartmouth College, which started competing in figure skating just 9 years ago, is attracting talented skaters who put the emphasis on teamwork and tallying a string of titles that is the envy of the country's 50 or so emerging programs. New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gorenstein reports.
When Dartmouth senior Catherine Kolaris takes first in her freestyle event Saturday at Hanover's Thompson Arena, she's mobbed by teammates. Her individual success has catapulted Dartmouth into the lead of the 2007 National Collegiate Figure Skating Championship. But the chance for a fourth consecutive title is not the only reason her teammates are celebrating. Former Dartmouth figure skater Emily Schaller explains.
Catherine Kolaris just skated her last program that she'll be skating here. She's a senior, she's just graduating, and she just skated the performance of her life, and I'm just so proud of her and so happy to be here to see it.
This moment exemplifies what fans say they enjoy about college figure skating, the element of teamwork. When most people think of figure skating, they see individuals practicing jumps and spins over and over again in the lonely early hours, and smiling sequined pixies on Olympic medal stands. Colorado High School senior Rory Grant says she's looking forward to leaving that world behind. Next fall, the skater will attend Dartmouth.
I think it'll be nice to finally be able to cheer for my friends and make the leap between being such like an independent, isolated person in my own sport to a team sport. I think it'll be really nice to have sort of that unity.
College figure skating actually rewards teamwork. Each event is broken up into levels, ranging from the top athletes to ones with less ability, but points are awarded equally within each category. U.S. figure skating helped organize the sport in 1996, and many teams are just now getting off the ground. The University of California at Berkeley team, for example, has no coach, no financial help from the school, and the closest rink is 20 minutes away by car, an hour on public transportation. They don't even have team practice. So as she sits in Thompson Arena just minutes away from the center of Dartmouth's campus, Berkeley skater Catherine Specht can't help but be a bit envious.
They are lucky in that they have a beautiful facility on campus. They have two coaches. They have funding and support from all these alumni groups. And they have tons of kids that want to skate for them.
Dartmouth has parlayed that support into a formidable figure skating program. Going into this year's championships, the team has won three consecutive titles. But life wasn't always so rosy. Amy Stetson founded the club as a junior in 1999. She remembers when team members had to pick leotards out of catalogs, stitch skirts around the waist, and hope they looked good enough. Stetson says at first, the team couldn't even count on transportation to their meets.
There was a snowstorm. We couldn't use the college-regulated bus, and we couldn't drive ourselves. And we know that we'll qualify for the first ever national championship if we can get to that event.
Stetson and a teammate were determined to find a solution. They made a call.
We found a limo, and it was a grungy-looking limo. We took the limo to MIT, pulled up at the rink, and there may have been only five of us. We jumped out of the limo and got on the ice and qualified to go to nationals.
Today, the team has about an $80,000 annual budget and no longer worries about making it to events. And Dartmouth president James Wright is one of the squad's top supporters.
I go to practices sometimes, and I do think there's a wonderful story in this figure skating team, the way they've come together in just such a short time, become a national power. And I love that. I love the story. I like what it says about them. I think it's more what it is that they represent that I value a lot.
What's striking about many of the figure skaters competing here in Hanover is how much of their lives they've devoted to the sport. Dartmouth junior Nicole Newman finished sixth in the 1999 Junior Olympics. To get there, she spent thousands of dollars on equipment, skate time, and coaching. She sacrificed much of her personal life for the sport. But she decided the Olympic route wasn't what she wanted.
After my ninth grade year, I think I just realized, okay, that Olympic goal is kind of over, and there's other goals I have for myself. I wanted to go to a good college, and if you're going to go to high school full-time, you're not going to do skating full-time. Those girls you see on TV are homeschooled, skating 6 hours a day, and that was just not something I wanted to do. I'm a very, like, social person. I wanted to have friends, experience high school, go to dances, and also do other sports besides skating.
Newman loves that she can keep skating after high school, but still have a life outside the sport. Last weekend, Newman didn't earn a gold medal. Instead, she finished first in her freestyle event, receiving 5 points that helped the team take its fourth consecutive title. For Only a Game, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
Berlin, New Hampshire calls itself the city that trees built, but the paper industry has been dying in Berlin for decades. And last spring, with the closing of two more paper mills, local industry has essentially disappeared. Today, unemployment has soared to 7%, almost double the statewide rate. But officials and locals believe a massive 7,200-acre state park might revitalize the city. The park, which opened last August, has been set aside for dirt spraying, off-roading, all-terrain vehicles. Can ATVs save Berlin? Keith O'Brien has the story.
On the shores of Jericho Lake, a few miles north of downtown Berlin, it is quiet but for the sound of wind and water. Bob Danderson, the mayor of Berlin, likes this sort of peace and quiet as much as anyone in the North Country. But what he'd really like to hear at Jericho Mountain State Park is some noise. Danderson, silver-haired and blue-eyed, revs up the engine on his brand-new Fire Engine Red two-man ATV. It's freezing outside, but Danderson, known to Berlin's 10,000 residents as simply Mayor Bob, is excited to be at the park. This is his baby, his idea. He first mentioned it to a state official in 2005.
He looked at me like I had two heads. He says, no one else wants them.
But Berlin did. In late 2005, the state approved a plan to buy the land from a logging company for $2.1 million. And since the park opened late last summer, Danderson has been out here all the time. He hits the gas, and together we tear off down a narrow, bumpy trail into the naked woods.
So how fast can you get this thing going, Bob?
Well, top speed on it's about 50 miles an hour.
50, 5-0?
50, yep.
Have you ever gone that fast?
On a logging road. The logging roads out here are like highways.
Jericho Mountain currently has just 18 miles of trail, which isn't much, considering that an enthusiastic ATV rider can easily go 40 miles in a day. But there are plans to build more. The master plan, completed last December, calls for 136 miles of trails, as well as 200 campsites, a boat ramp, public restrooms, and a general store. It's a plan that has some people, including environmentalists, worried. But locals, tired of losing jobs, paper mills, and workers, are excited about what's happening in the woods on the edge of town. Dick Hewat, president of the Androscoggin Valley ATV Club, believes the park will do the unthinkable, turn Berlin into a tourist destination.
We've had a lot of people that had to leave. Our high school graduates, there's an exodus every year. There's an exodus of high school graduates that leave. They go get educated, and there's no real job for them to come back to, so they stay away. But I know that a lot of those people would love to come back if they had an opportunity to come back too. So we're hoping, I'm hoping, that this is part of that opportunity that'll get the people to come back.
It's not the craziest idea ever conceived, even here in remote Berlin, 180 miles north of Boston, nestled in the mountains, a short drive from the main border. In fact, building ATV parks to generate buzz has been done before in rural America, and done well. Just ask Jeffrey Lusk.
I think they can transform the economy of a rural area.
Lusk would know. He is executive director of the Hatfield-McCoy Regional Recreation Authority, an agency created by the West Virginia legislature to oversee 578 miles of ATV trails in five poor rural counties. The trails first opened in October 2000, and the initial impact was marginal. Less than 4,000 permits were sold the first year. But last year, Hatfield-McCoy sold more than 26,000 permits. One recent study estimated the trails have generated $7.7 million in direct spending, while also creating about 150 local jobs.
An even better look at this would be that we have 53 lodging providers that did not exist in October of 2000. 53 new companies that have opened up who provide lodging to trail riders. You know, that's the biggest impact. What we have saw is the trail system has just created opportunities for entrepreneurs. You know, we have brought a new economic base into this area, and that new economic base creates opportunities for entrepreneurs.
Down on Main Street in Berlin, Scott Gregory, the owner of T-Bird's Cafe, likes the sound of that.
Dollars and cents ringing in Berlin, New Hampshire.
His cafe is about 500 feet west of the old pulp mill, now shuttered and being dismantled. And while this brought him customers when the mill was open, it also brought an unwelcome guest.
The smell of the pulp mill was somewhere around burnt cabbage to rotten eggs on a bad day. Most days you didn't smell it, but the ones you did made up for the ones you didn't. And it was pretty bad. It had its really bad moments.
Now this smell, which locals say once impregnated their clothes, their cars, their businesses, is gone. And the 800 jobs from this and a second mill are gone too. But thanks to the Jericho Mountain ATV Park, there is hope in Berlin. And to some, it looks like Randy Cicchetto. Cicchetto moved here from Rochester, New Hampshire last summer and opened the first new ATV-related business, Jericho Motorsports. Located just outside the park, it's a place where people can rent ATVs and curl up in front of Cicchetto's fireplace with a mug of warm cocoa when they're done. It is, for Cicchetto, a dream come true.
The snowmobile industry has probably reached its peak, but the ATV industry is growing leaps and bounds because, let's face it, there's not as much snow as there used to be. Either that or we're getting taller. For the ATV industry, the expansion is coming.
This is what troubles Andrew Walters. As founder of ATV Watch, a New Hampshire group dedicated to protecting the environment from ATVs, he wishes the people of Berlin all the best. And in fact, he did not oppose the park when it was first being developed.
We never took a position because we didn't know whether it was going to be the answer to our problems or whether it was going to be the start of bigger problems. We were hopeful that perhaps Jericho Mountain State Park would allow ATV trails to be removed from other more sensitive state lands, and that we could have an isolated ATV park, and that that perhaps was a good compromise.
Has that proven to be the case?
No.
Walter says he's worried that the park has been opened without proper regard for the environment, and the state still plans to open more ATV trails elsewhere. According to the park's master plan, the goal is to open 350 miles of trails statewide in the next 5 years, the equivalent of almost three Jericho Mountains. More trails could lead to more ATV sales, Walter says, and more ATVs could lead to an increased demand for still more trails. And in the years ahead, that can make this sound more common. It's hours after we first set out on the back of Mayor Bob Danerson's red ATV, and here he is, still sloshing through a muddy, half-frozen mess. He is giddy out here in the wilderness, but on this day, what he finds waiting for him back at the parking lot makes him even happier. It's a tourist driving a car with Massachusetts license plates.
Look at that.
Drive up one and drive down the other.
Isn't that what this is all about?
Oh, yeah.
See the tags? Massachusetts tags, and we love them.
For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien in Berlin, New Hampshire.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to Bill's weekly commentary, or to longer versions of our conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. You're listening to Only a Game. Charlie Pierce's remarks last week inspired Only a Game listeners to flood our mailbox with comments. Doug Reynolds from Cambridge, Massachusetts, took exception with Charlie's characterization of 66-year-old Don Imus as a pathetic 70-year-old bad boy. Other than that, Mr. Reynolds wrote, I pretty much agreed with all Mr. Pierce said. The only part I can remember, however, is the 70-year-old slur. Dan Stein listens to Only a Game on WAMC in New York State. After professing his undying admiration for our program, Mr. Stein offers the following suggestion for improvement. Prior to your weekly segment with Charlie Pierce, insert a sock or similar muffling material into Mr. Pierce's mouth, wrap duct tape several times around his head, and firmly secure the material into this overactive orifice of his. Bill Fischel, who listens on Vermont Public Radio, joined the chorus. Charlie Pierce's response to the Duke lacrosse player's acquittal was truly over the top. He has to bring his own politics into it and rant about Guantanamo. Come on, Charlie, think about the name of the show. However, Richard Klass, who listens on Minnesota Public Radio in St. Peter, wrote to say, when Charlie linked the Duke situation with Guantanamo and what has become of America and its Constitution, well, at that moment, the sun shone through my bedroom window, and I felt for the first time in a very long time that there may be hope. Mr. Klass was not alone in appreciating Charlie's comments. He was joined by many others, including Vermont listener Pete Osler, who writes, your commentary made my day and probably my week, and maybe my month. Fat white men bloviating indeed. Smiley face. A number of listeners also wrote in to correct Bill Littlefield on his knowledge of the Cricket World Cup again. Dr. Phil Jerzyk, who listens on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, asked that Bill refrain from making further comments on the Cricket World Cup, saying, today you said Australia had won the cup. Hold on there. The final won't be decided until April 28th in Barbados. Maybe you can find a friend with Dish TV and tune in. And finally, a correction that I cannot blame on Bill Littlefield. Last week, I said that Dina Castor was attempting to become the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since Joan Benoit Samuelson in 1982. That was wrong. The last American woman to win Boston was Lisa Larsen Weidenbach in 1985. If you have a comment, concern, or yet another correction, write us at Only a Game, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can send an email to oag@wbur.bu.edu or leave a message on our listener line, 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. This is NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is off gathering palm fronds with which to celebrate the return of the Boston Breakers. Ahead on Only a Game, the Olympic torch relay myth debunked. But first, Charlie Pierce is here to discuss the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
The show is going to break my heart again.
It
sure
is.
Debunking the torch relay.
It sure is. The Penguins are out of the Stanley Cup playoffs. They were eliminated on Thursday. Too bad, because it would seem the NHL needs for people to see more of Sidney Crosby, don't you think?
Can't they make Sidney a senator for another couple of weeks? I mean, they could do almost anything. No one's noticing. They could have him play for every team like Pele did that one year. Yeah, they were not a factor. They lost in five pretty easy games. They got shut out in game five by Ray Emery, who, an unremarkable goaltender on his best day. Sidney's first pro season ends with him probably doing television, I would think, the rest of the way.
The New York Rangers swept the Atlanta Thrashers in the first round, marking the first time the Rangers have made it to the second round in a decade. Team captain Jaromir Jagr said, quote, "As long as we stay healthy, we have a pretty good chance to go somewhere." Where might that somewhere be?
Probably, I would think, the next round. Boy, I would like to thank the. We have some lovely parting gifts for the Atlanta Thrashers, who were barely in the, who barely made the playoffs, and then barely showed any presence at all while they were there. It is good, and I hate to sound like a marketing guy, but it is good for the NHL to have the New York teams still alive.
Well, help me out here, Charlie. Last season, Alex Rodriguez was a self-centered jerk who hit to pad his own stats and didn't hit in the clutch. Now he's the greatest guy in the world, at least according to Yankees fans. What's going on?
Well, we like fans. We have, you know, we like fans. Fans are our bread and butter. This program even has several. But many of them are jackasses. Alex Rodriguez, I guarantee you that if Alex Rodriguez continues on and hits, he's on a pace to hit like 90 home runs now. If he hits 90 home runs and then hits 240 in the first round of the playoffs, he's a bum again. Fans are jackasses.
Less than 3 weeks into the season, Major League Baseball already has its first no-hitter. Chicago White Sox pitcher Mark Burley was only one walk away from a perfect game against the Texas Rangers. Not bad for a guy who doesn't have a contract for next season.
Oh, but they haven't gotten the marching band out of his agent's office yet. This was terrific. A very efficient, a two-hour game. He faced the minimum batters. He walked Sammy Sosa, who then brilliantly got picked off first base. So he faced the 27 batters that you face. A marvel of efficiency, and oddly enough, the 16th no-hitter in the history of the White Sox. The second most no-hitters in the history of one franchise in baseball, the leader being the Los Angeles Dodgers, which is sort of unfair because Sandy Koufax counts there.
Though it's not a sports story, I'm compelled to bring up the Virginia Tech massacre, Charlie. This week, VT alum Michael Vick donated $10,000 to assist victims' families. The Washington Nationals wore VT caps to show their support. Those efforts are laudable, but I'm left wondering, what, if anything, can sports stars really do to help in situations like this?
Well, I think, you know, Michael Vick said that the $10,000, he said if he can help in some small way, it's the least he can do. Rest your conscience, Michael, you did the least you could do. I think the symbolic thing with the Washington Nationals was very nice. I don't envy, quite frankly, the Virginia Tech football team next year or the Virginia Tech basketball team next year. They're going to be inundated with people wanting to know what they're doing, what they're, you know, are they helping the community heal? Are they performing their therapeutic function? And these are kids who are going to have to try to play a football schedule and a basketball schedule in a crazy kind of general atmosphere there. And I don't envy them their seasons.
On Tuesday, the Tampa Sports Authority asked a federal appeals court to reinstate pat-down searches at Tampa Bay Buccaneer football games. The searches became NFL policy after September 11th, but they have been challenged in Tampa, Chicago, Seattle, and San Francisco. The U.S. Justice Department argued that, quote, "there is no constitutional right to watch a football game live." So, Charlie, as our resident constitutional law scholar, would you agree?
Well, given the current Department of Justice, which is somewhere between a Wednesday night bowling league in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and the Marx Brothers. I have no doubt that they feel that way, that it's okay to have Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights as long as you sort of keep them in your living room on the mantelpiece and don't take them out in public. I applaud the judge that overturned this policy in Florida. I'm not sanguine about whether or not his decision will stand, however.
The new Women's Soccer League, which has taken up the name of the once-defunct WUSA, has announced that the Boston Breakers will be among the 8 teams to begin play in 2008. And since Bill's not here, we can be honest about this. I wonder what chances the league has to make it work this time.
Let's see. I mean, it's a tiny niche sport. Let's hope they're satisfied. I hope it survives. There's a Women's World Cup coming up. That generally pumps up the interest in it for a while. You know, there's always going to be somebody who wants to try this, and good for them.
And finally, Charlie, for the second time since 2003, Boston Marathon organizers played the wrong national anthem for a Russian champion. Lydia Grigorieva says she was too busy accepting her olive wreath and trophy on Monday to notice the mistake, but I'm sure you caught on right away.
I did not, because I wasn't watching the award ceremony. But yeah, the anthem that Russia has now is the same melody as the old Soviet Union anthem. It has different lyrics, probably involving McDonald's and blue jeans. You have to remember, the Boston Marathon on the women's side has come a long way in the 30 years since the day they couldn't tell you who won the race. So I think confusing the national anthems is a sign of real progress.
Well, what do you think? In honor of Ms. Grigorieva, do you think we can hum a few bars? Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe and is always good for a chorus or two when he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie. David Clay Large opens his new book, Nazi Games, the Olympics of 1936, with the image of 15 Greek maidens lighting the Olympic torch at the ruins of Olympia's ancient stadium. It's a peaceful and serene beginning to what would become the most controversial of the modern Olympic Games. David Clay Large joins me from Yellowstone Public Radio in Bozeman, Montana. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's stick with that opening image for a while. The Olympic torch relay was new in 1936. It had been dreamed up by Nazi propagandists. The torch passed through Greece, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Austria, and Czechoslovakia before arriving in Berlin. Those familiar with world history are going to realize right away that those countries all had something in common.
Yes, they were all eventually taken over or overrun by the Wehrmacht. And in some ways, you can see this torch relay, supposedly a peaceful exercise, as a prelude to the aggression that was to come in World War II.
Well, given that this so-called tradition was used in such an overtly political way by the Nazis, how did the torch relay become a continuing part of the Olympic Games?
Well, it was very dramatically powerful. It was something that the Greeks themselves were delighted with and backed. It served very effectively to advertise the games around the world. I mean, nothing could be better than taking this torch through a number of countries to the host site. It also served as a kind of symbolic link between Nazi Germany and ancient Greece. That was the idea, to suggest that the Nazis were the true heirs of the ancients.
And you point out in your book that's kind of a dubious link there.
Oh, it's very dubious. Nonetheless, symbolically, it was very powerful at the time. And did serve to suggest this linkage, which then the organizers of the 36 Games did everything in their power to perpetuate. They put on artistic exhibitions of ancient Greek statuary. They sponsored excavations at ancient Olympia. The Germans had already pioneered in those in the 1880s, and the Nazis resumed those in 1936 as if, again, to suggest this very strong tie between ancient Greece at its height and its glory and Nazi Germany.
You make the point that if it had been up to the U.S. Embassy officials in Berlin, the United States would have likely boycotted the 1936 Games. But instead, the most vocal and influential voice on the matter came from Avery Brundage, who declared Berlin to be a fit host for the Games after taking a six-day fact-finding tour, and I love this, arranged by an old German drinking buddy. How did Brundage secure Americans' participation in these Games?
Well, you have to remember that Avery Brundage was extremely influential in American sports. He was the head of the American Olympic Committee, the AOC, in those days. He also was very influential within the Amateur Athletic Union, which had to certify track athletes for the Games. So he had two very decisive positions within the world of American sport, and he was a persuasive guy. And he used that influence wherever he could to promote the idea, first, that the Games shouldn't be political in any event, that they were above politics, therefore whatever the National Socialists were doing was not terribly relevant. That was one argument he made. The second argument he made is that for all practical purposes, the Nazis were abiding by Olympic rules and principles. He used his influence very effectively. He threatened people who opposed him with expulsion from the AOC, and eventually, in fact, he did manage to expel several dissidents from the organization after 1936. He used similar tactics in the AAU. He resorted to anti-Semitism along the way, threatening Jews that if they persisted in opposing American participation in the Games, they would suffer at home. So he used whatever tactics were necessary. He also published a pamphlet that smeared opponents to American participation in the Games as communists, as traitors, as left-wingers whose sole purpose was to besmirch the tradition of the Olympics.
Much has been made of Jesse Owens' record-breaking effort in Berlin. Most of the oversimplified accounts make it sound like he was all alone in Nazi Germany. But in fact, there were 19 blacks on America's track and field teams, and their medal total was higher than any other country's track and field squad. This must not have made the Nazi organizers very happy.
No, it certainly didn't. They would have preferred, obviously, that the blacks didn't win anything. That would have been their wish. But they did find ways to explain or to justify, to interpret these black victories that coincided with certain racial stereotypes that were beginning to emerge about blacks as being particularly gifted in certain kinds of athletic endeavor, jumping and sprinting, but which also claimed that these same blacks couldn't be good at sports requiring discipline, strategy, and mm-hmm. things of that sort. For example, there were those who said, well, okay, sure, blacks can jump high and run fast, but they don't have endurance, so they'll never be good in long-distance running, for example. tell that to the Kenyans who just won the Boston Marathon. Or another expert, an American expert, viewing all of this, said, yes, blacks may be able to run fast, but they don't have teamwork, so they'll never be good in basketball.
Well, Hitler's famous snub, refusing to shake the hand of Jesse Owens after he won the first of his four gold medals, mm-hmm. wasn't exactly what it was made out to be either. I understand the handshaking controversy did not begin or end with Jesse Owens.
That's right. There's this myth that Hitler purposefully and specifically snubbed Jesse Owens. That's not the case. What happened is that on the first day of the competitions, Hitler did personally congratulate a number of athletes, some Germans, some Finns. And this is not something he was supposed to do. Heads of state at the Olympic Games are not supposed to publicly congratulate athletes. So Hitler was acting out of turn there. What happened after that is that the president of the International Olympic Committee, Henri Bellet-Latour, went to Hitler and said, look, if you want to personally congratulate athletes after their victories, you're going to have to congratulate every one of them down the line without fail. You can't make any exceptions. You can't treat them differently. And so Hitler decided at that point he wouldn't congratulate any of the victors personally in the stadium from then on. So it wasn't that Hitler was specifically singling out Owens, but we know from private comments that he made to his aides and so forth that he never would have shaken Jesse Owens' hand. He was as prejudiced against blacks as he was against Jews, and there's no question that he would have done that had the occasion arisen. But I should hasten to add that Owens himself didn't feel snubbed by Hitler. In fact, on the contrary, he rather admired Hitler. He thought Hitler had some pretty good ideas. And after the games, when he eventually came back to the United States, he went around giving speeches saying that it was not Hitler who snubbed him, but Franklin Roosevelt, because Franklin Roosevelt had not sent him a telegram to congratulate him on any of his four victories at the games. And he proceeded also to suggest that Roosevelt was a socialist and unworthy of being president. And so Jesse Owens campaigned for Alf Landon in 1936 against Roosevelt, and further suggested that it would be good policy for the United States to work more closely with Nazi Germany.
After the games, the athletes themselves, especially those who competed for Germany, seem to have had a very hard time acknowledging the Nazi propaganda inherent in the 36 games. Why did people like Helena Mayer, the lone German Jewish participant, and Rudolf Ismayer, who recited the Olympic Oath, have such a hard time seeing the games for what they were?
Well, I think that's understandable. You have to understand these people trained hard, endlessly, to reach the Olympic level. They put everything into it. This was their great moment. So I think it's psychologically perfectly understandable that they would later on insist that the games really hadn't been misused for political purposes. Ismayer was actually on the left. He went on to argue this along with some more conservative veterans of the German teams because, again, this was so important, such an important moment in their lives. I think they just remained blind to what in fact happened in 1936, and that is that the games were used for political purposes. There's no doubt about that. The Nazis cleverly exploited the whole Olympic tradition for their own gains, which is not to say that every athlete was directly sort of culpable in all of this. That's not the case. Some of the German athletes were National Socialists. Some identified thoroughly with the regime's ideals. Others did not, like Werner Seelenbinder, who was a wrestler and who would have, had he won a medal, apparently used that occasion to protest against Nazi policies. So there were different political creeds involved there, but I think no athlete would want to think of this great moment in their lives as somehow tarnished by political manipulation.
David Clay Large wrote Nazi Games, the Olympics of 1936, published by Norton. David, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Maggie You've Ruined the Torch Relay Haskins. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Nazi games, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Charlie Pierce, as per request of one of our letter-writing listeners. Don't worry, Charlie fans, the sock comes out in a couple of days. I'm Karen Given. Thanks for listening. Bill Littlefield returns next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.